Welcome to Journal Spotting. Want to understand the planetary impact of the medications you prescribe whilst also enjoying your high tea? Your ears are in the right place. This is a general medicine podcast that will bring you a monthly roundup of the top practice-changing articles, along with specialist interviews, guidelines, and more. We scour the journals so you don't have to. This is The Climate Zone.
Welcome back to another Climate Zone, listeners.
We hope you've been following our series and you enjoyed our last Climate Zone episode, where we had three like really inspiring medical students. They put my medical sort of my time at university to shame. And these guys may well be the future leaders of our healthcare services and maybe even saviors of the planet. I mean, you know, not too much on their shoulders, though. Not too much. But it was an excellent interview. So if you haven't listened to that, go check it out.
And for this Climate Zone, listeners, LJ, can you introduce our guest?
Yes. So I had a great time speaking to Tracy Lyons and Minna I. They're both specialist pharmacists and they're co-founders of Pharmacy Declares. So doing tons in the world of pharmacy and the climate.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it, LJ. From your interview, these guys are involved in every aspect of pharmaceuticals, pharmacy, and, you know, and the climate. It was really interesting to hear about. For the listeners, what you're going to hear is a discussion which covers topics such as the carbon life cycle of medications, how the carbon cost is, of course, really, really important, but it's not the only issue, and it's actually sort of slightly dangerous just to concentrate on that. How climate change itself is affecting things like procurement of medications and storage of medications in heat waves, storms, all these sorts of things, which is really interesting. Then we talk about medication wastage and how that's a massive problem. And most importantly, what healthcare professionals can do to improve the situation. These topics that they cover are really, really important and relevant to absolutely anybody in healthcare. So I think our listeners are in for a treat.
Great stuff. And if you want to hear how we got on with the latest climate challenge, then listen on to the end of the show. It's going to be poetry to your ears, or at least attempted poetry. And don't forget, if you want to get up to date with the latest in medical literature, head over to one of our roundup episodes. If you want to be inspired by professors, doctors in far-off lands, or hear activist adventures, go and listen to our special interviews. There's lots on the channel to explore.
That's right. And if you like the show, please share us with anyone who you think cares about the environment, who might be interested in learning what they can do. And if you have any ideas or feedback or anything like that about the show, just get in touch or emailing us on journalspotting.com or tweet us. Finally, listeners, if you want all the pearls of our Journal Spotting beavers at your fingertips in a neat app, go to journalclub.messly.com. The links will be in the show notes and on our website. So go and check it out. And essentially, this is a web app which is going to be regularly updated with a list of really important or interesting articles, which are both covered on the podcast and not covered on the podcast. So a whole range of things there. So go and check it out.
Yeah, thanks to Messly, who developed the app with us, alongside providing an excellent service in which they act as a kind of like a go-between doctors and locum agencies. And they also support doctors that are out of training in lots of different ways. So check out the website, www.messly.com, for loads more information.
All right, guys. LJ, let's hear the interview.
Enjoy.
Thank you so much for joining me today. It's great to see you. We're here to talk about pharmacy and pharmaceuticals and the climate crisis. So thank you, because I know you've both got lots to say on this topic. It'd be really great if you could introduce yourselves to our audience and then we'll get going.
Hello, thank you, Alja, for inviting us here today. My name's Mina and I'm currently an acute medicine pharmacist and based up in the Northeast for another week or so before I move down to Cornwall and be a full-time student again. So I also am the Vice Chair of Sustainability in the Guild of Healthcare Pharmacists, trying to roll out this agenda in the UK and across our European colleagues coming up as well. Got loads of exciting projects.
Hi, also for me, thanks so much for inviting us on. My name's Tracy Lyons and I'm a medicines optimization pharmacist who's just had sustainability put into her job title at the University Hospitals Dorset NHS Trust, so that's really exciting. I am a co-founder of Pharmacy Declares with Minna and I'm the sustainability advisor for the UK Clinical Pharmacy Association.
Fantastic. Okay, extremely well qualified for this discussion. So thanks so much for finding the time. I wanted to start with sort of thinking about how pharmaceuticals sort of fit into the NHS net zero pledges. So I think the whole of the NHS net zero work and the document delivering a net zero NHS has been a really huge catalyst to making change in the NHS and helping people to see how the climate crisis is a health crisis and how it's connected to lots of the NHS's activity, including travel, energy consumption, and the kind of direct care. I think one thing that might strike people is that in that document, it's highlighted that medicines account for about 25% of carbon emissions within the NHS. And it'd be great if you could explain a little bit about where those carbon emissions come from when we're thinking about medicines.
So we were just chatting before we came on earlier about there's so much to cover in this question, essentially. We want to talk about the life cycle analysis of drugs, and there's just a lack of data of it out there. I believe pharma companies have got them, it's just they need to be more transparent, essentially. They talk about also, I've been at a conference recently in London, and the weekend just gone, they talked about green chemistry and the whole manufacture process, acquiring active pharmaceutical ingredients that are sourced ethically, like not just about the environment, but ensuring there's no child labor involved. So there's these metrics developed by the British Standard Institute, the UN Development Programme, working with governments the common countries where APIs are sourced, such as India and China, and ensuring that the whole process is as green and ethical as possible. There's also things like overprescribing that we need to tackle, essentially to reduce the use of drugs in the first place. The cynical side of me thought that if people need to start paying for the drugs, there won't be as much waste and emissions that, as there are now. And currently the people controlling these emissions are clinicians, and I think it's our job to kind of educate them and how to kind of tackle the deprescribing. And Tracy, you probably have in your role for more to say about the procurement side of things.
Before we do that, do you mind just explaining a little bit more about what you mean by life cycle analysis? Because not everyone will know that term.
Sure. So a life cycle analysis breaks down the individual stages that occur between a drug being designed within a trial to patient use. And, you know, we know that each of those are associated with workforce, with energy use, et cetera, et cetera. So each stage has its own carbon footprint. So you can look at design in a trial. You can look at manufacture, transport, packaging, public relations, et cetera, for branded medication. And when you encompass those all together, that's what you call the life cycle carbon footprint of a drug. And at the moment, what we have is a few life cycle analyses or LCAs for a few drugs, but we don't really have enough information about many of the drugs, which is why we can't give precise information for individual medications. So at the moment, we think that the majority of the carbon footprint of a medication comes from manufacture. We just don't know, so we really need lots more information.
And does that include disposal as well, that life cycle?
Yes, it includes disposal as well. And different methods of disposal have different energy requirements. They have different environmental impacts. So it really should be cradle to grave for the medication. That's how we call it. That's what we call it.
So that's a really great start in helping us to understand that every single bit step in the process of making and using and disposing of a medicine has a carbon footprint associated with it. But you've already touched on the fact that there are other things we should think about when we're thinking about medicines. You've touched on the ethical aspects of it. I feel that there is a lot of focus on net zero, and that's very helpful because it helps us to quantify what we're doing, and it means we can have metrics. And it's obviously very relevant when we think about certain medications, so anaesthetic gases and inhalers. But I think some people have very rightly challenged the limits of a carbon footprint approach because it misses some of the other environmental impacts. Can you say anything more about what we might miss if we have too narrow a focus on carbon footprint?
So we talked about the NHS Scotland's sustainability agenda has just been published, I believe, last month. They had a focus beyond just carbon. They talk about One Health and kind of medication pollution and waterways. And we had the recent report of how pharmaceuticals were found in when they sampled 250-something rivers. Some of our members in Pharmacy Declares are oncology pharmacists, and they wrote an article recently that talked about, you know, feminization of male fish embryos following environmental exposure to hormonal contraception, increase in DNA damage and decrease in reproductive potential of crustaceans following exposure to anti-cancer drugs. I think these things are like not commonly known. And I believe a few years back as well, there was a massive report of diclofenac in an environment that was causing vultures to have acute kidney injuries and subsequently die of renal failure. So things like that are quite impactful to obviously our wildlife, our animals, and that's something that we can control and should manage.
I mean, the other thing that we really want to raise, we want to like shout about this from the rooftops, is that with environmental pollution with pharmaceuticals, you have to think about antimicrobial resistance, which we know, you know, we're really focused on climate change, aren't we? But you can't ignore AMR. It's a global health threat in its own right. And the way we use drugs is contributing towards that. So we know that, you know, if the majority of our drugs are produced in India and Asia, we know that environmental regulations there aren't as strong. And the way that the compounds are produced are contributing to these vast pots of antimicrobial resistance in that area. And, you know, we have to completely get over the NIMBYism in regard to this. You know, what's somebody else's problem is also ours, because, you know, antimicrobial resistance jumps on a plane. It doesn't need a passport. It's going to be here really soon. And we have, you know, studied UN reports that said, you know, there are various pharmaceutical production plants in India that are producing antimicrobials. And there was one that always sticks in my mind, and it's there's a plant in Hyderabad in India that produces ciprofloxacin. And when they looked at the amount of drug in the local waterways, it was enough to treat 44,000 people. You know, so it's just a massive issue. It's something we can't ignore. And I know Greener NHS are doing this amazing work. They're throwing all of their resources on carbon emissions, because climate change is, you know, it's the greatest health threat we'll ever face. But we can't ignore the side effects as well. We've done a lot of work with NHS Ocean, who's, you know, Richard Hickson, who's doing this amazing work looking at oceanic health. And you think, you know, if all of our drugs are being shipped from India and China to Europe to be packaged and then maybe shipped somewhere else again to be used, that's an awful lot of transport of drugs all over the world. You know, and that comes with fossil fuel used to get them everywhere. There's ship pollution. There's, you know, Richard did this amazing talk where he said that, you know, species are actually transported in ballast water of ships from one part of the world to the other. So you have introduction of invasive species, all sorts of things. So, yeah, we really have to think beyond just carbon as well. So that will be the end goal, I think.
It really seems like the more you look, the more impacts there are that we're just not really thinking about. So when I'm, you know, prescribing my antibiotics to my patient in the hospital, I'm not seeing this huge journey that drug has taken to get to me and all of the massive impacts that have come before that. So that's a really helpful description. I wonder also, something that I think is getting more focus, particularly with things like ocean health, is the plastic pollution associated. I think that's a real worry for people.
Yeah, I don't think people really realise, do they? So the fact that always sticks in my mind is that medical plastic makes up 2% of global plastic use, and that, you know, it's increasing by, I think it's about 6% every year, which is just phenomenal. And I think in pharmacies, actually, you see the packaging build up all of the time. And there's a little bit of work to try and remedy that, but at the moment, there's nothing you can do except incinerate it. So, and we know that the plastics get into the environment, and they're enzyme disruptors as well, hormonal disruptors. And so, you know, this is something we really have to look at alongside the drugs.
Moving slightly away from the kind of impact of pharmaceuticals themselves and their production on the climate, something that is really worrying is the impacts of the climate crisis on healthcare. And obviously there's quite a bit of talk about mitigation and about supply lines. Can you say what you've seen and what the predictions are for what impact the climate crisis might have on our ability to make and transport and store medicines that might have an impact in health systems globally?
So I think recent examples, if you must use, look at the recent storm Arwen that we had, and storm after storm. In the Northeast, we've seen power outages for weeks. A week of people haven't had power for a week. And you think about people on fridge line medications, that means there's nowhere to store their medications in the fridge for a week. And also, it's just basic, you know, where do you get water from if your water supply is interrupted as well? And when there's floods, basic things to take your medication with. And recently in the summer, we had the record-breaking heat waves again. And this is going to be happening year on year if we don't, you know, try and reduce the global temperature rise. And the temperatures deviation in heat waves as well, in terms of managing stability of medications. No one's actually looked at the stability of medication when patients store medications in their lockers on the ward that's overheated. And the hospital buildings are currently not adapted to you know, sustain in this amount of heat. So I think there'll be more adaptation plans that need to be drawn up for, you know, even in for pharmacies that are based in basements, for example, or in flood zones. I don't even know if they have plans for what's happening with, and you know, thousands or million worth of pounds of drugs are going to be lost and damaged if we don't have great adaptation plans. And I suppose we should be drawing expertise from, you know, clinicians who's working in kind of disaster zones, third world countries. And maybe we should be working in synergy with them to draw up these adaptation plans.
Yeah, you know, we've just had examples from international extreme weather events like Hurricane Katrina, which wiped out manufacturing plants, which impacted the global supply. You know, one of the hats that I wear at work is in pharmaceutical procurement. And, you know, you can see it happening when there are a limited number of pharmaceutical manufacturing plants globally. And it's such an international business. When one goes down, it's like a domino effect. So it affects so many people. And the other thing that we've seen from the procurement side of things is, you know, with the COVID pandemic, when countries go into lockdown, you know, people stay at home. Factories don't work, you know, in some places, and it really has an impact there on, you know, how frequently and how commonly we encountered problems with our supply chain in the UK. You know, again, it comes down to, you know, we're not isolated, we don't produce our own drugs, so everything that happens everywhere else impacts on us. And I've just got to finish with a local situation that occurred, and it relates back to the, you know, the heat waves that Minna mentioned over the summer. Here is during the period of high temperature, one of the main pharmacy wholesalers in the UK actually said, you know, we normally deliver to you twice a day, but in this hot weather, we're only going to deliver once a day in the morning, and we're going to reduce your cutoff time. So it threw, you know, hospitals into, you know, this real state of, you know, what drugs do we order? Do we have to increase our orders? You know, it's such a change. And that's because the companies can't promise to deliver the drugs in a safe way. So, you know, at the moment, when we work with pharma wholesalers, we sort of talk to them and say, you know, have you got snow contingency plans? But, you know, I think going forward, we really need to say to them, you know, have you got a heatwave plan? And what, you know, do you have access to boats if all the hospitals are flooded or something? You know, these are the big things we really need to look at.
Gosh, that's the stuff of nightmares. Someone's got to make a plan for all this contingency, for all these possible disasters. And I know hospitals definitely have climate adaptation plans, and I think that's increasingly what all organisations are going to need. But you just start to realise how complex the system is, particularly with things like deliveries and it being such a global industry, that you're absolutely right. We are not isolated as much as some people would like to think. We're, you know, this plucky independent nation. It's absolute rubbish. We are so dependent on the global system. That we've really, really, I guess it just adds more need for us to really take this seriously and to act so that we're not adding to the problem.
And I don't think sometimes that when you have a resilience team, they realise exactly how many different arms they need to look at. I think at the moment, everyone's starting to think about heat, but you know, that might be the least of your problem.
So that's a lot of problems we've thrown up and a lot of difficult things to try and solve, which we're going to have to get very expert at pretty quickly. But this comes us to sort of start to think about what the role is of healthcare professionals in this, because we're the ones who will be having to deal with a lot of the crises kind of, you know, day to day when there are no drugs being delivered, or there is a heat wave and the fridges have all gone down or whatever. So I think often we are very well placed to be seeing what's happening, but that also means we're perhaps very well placed to also be sounding the alarm and telling people that we need to act. And you've obviously both done this really brilliantly through Pharmacy Declares. So it'd be great to hear how that started and what you found, some wins and what you've learned. You can fill us in.
I think I'll have to thank Tracy for this one. So Tracy put out a call through Health Declares a couple of years ago. It was during lockdown, I believe. And I think a handful of people responded, and we met up virtually during lockdown. And that kind of coming together, the rewarding feeling of finding like-minded people in your profession that shares the passion to take climate action personally and professionally. And some people are, so at that point, I was very in the beginning of my journey in terms of sustainability and how to, you know, professionally and in personal life. Whereas the likes of Tracy and, you know, Martin, they're like way, like they've been at this for 10 years or so. So I've got to learn a lot from them. And we learn so much from each other. None of us like proclaim ourselves as subject matter experts. And we welcome all kinds of people in our group who wants to join us. Some people are involved in different areas and share learnings and findings in terms of, you know, some people are in policy, in primary care. One of our members, Nuala, is working in CPPE, Centre for Postgraduate Pharmacy Education. And they recently launched a learning gateway for an environment and sustainability for pharmacists and, you know, pharmacy students to access, because this is the main platform where pharmacists access education, and especially they train up a lot of PCN pharmacists through this platform. So we're looking for more, you know, community pharmacy involvement. It'd be good to have a pharma company, you know, industrial pharmacists in the team as well to get insight on what could be done, and, you know, collaborative working. Would you say, Tracy?
Oh, completely. I just have to say thank you so much for asking this, because we love this question. Because, you know, in all else, like everything you encompass in sustainability, if you really get the message, it can be quite overwhelming, isn't it? So this is just such a nice thing to come back to every now and again. But, you know, we've had 7 organisations declare a climate emergency, which in itself is really big for us, because, you know, Greener NHS said, you know, we want every single member of the NHS involved in healthcare to sort of be on board. And that's a monumental task. They can't do that on their own. So they really need professional organisations to sort of explain what the problem is and declare a climate emergency. So that for us is fantastic. We've had millions of pounds divested from fossil fuels, which I know globally is just a drop in the ocean, but, you know, has to count as a really wonderful thing. And as Minna said, you know, we've just grown in strength, and what I really love is the way that everybody's collaborating and sharing knowledge. You know, I know nothing about education, but Minna set up this national pharmacy education network that's really changing the way that future students will be educated and trained and have this understanding of climate health and planetary health. It's just brilliant, and I love watching what everybody does.
That's great to hear. I totally agree that the only way to do any of this is to do it together with other people who get it and who are really doing amazing things. But they are really huge kind of measurable outcomes from quite a small team. So I think that's fantastic. In terms of thinking about some of the education that you've been doing and some of those modules and things that are for pharmacists, what sort of things do you include? What do you tell pharmacy professionals that they can do in their work? Because sometimes it's a bit hard to think what you can do on the ground and really match up these sort of big, bold statements about what we need to do and the changes you're making at home. So how do you help pharmacy professionals kind of make this real in their jobs?
We've got lots of resources on our website already if people want to check out as a start what we've been working on and see how you can implement it in your local workplaces. But I'll let Tracy lead on this one. She's collaborated with a few amazing people to produced this sustainability checklist for the integrated care systems in England, the ICSs. There is things like formulary changes as well. In my trust, for example, we're only contracted for Salamol brand of inhalers. We don't have any contracts with Ventolin brand, and that's a 10 kilogram carbon dioxide equivalent difference. So things like that in looking at the procurement tender processes can make a difference. And Tracy, did you want to talk about the sustainability checklist?
I'd love to. That's okay. Yeah. This is something that's just hit the press in the last couple of days. And I worked with a really fantastic pharmacist called Aileen O'Hare, who's just finished a Chief Pharmaceutical Officer's Fellowship at the General Pharmaceutical Council. We basically sat down and said, you know, pharmacy teams up and down the country are going to be looking at what they can do, because, you know, people like Min and I are going out saying you have to do something, you know, but then the question comes back, well, what next? And you can look at the established greener NHS programs, the Medicines Net Zero programs, and they are brilliant, but there has to be a lot more. And what we've done is produced, in collaboration again with lots of other experts in different fields, is a checklist of how you can essentially bolt on sustainability to existing work plans. So a lot of it revolves around, you know, messaging, making sure people know that any way that you optimize healthcare, help people use their medicines correctly, or stop, even better, stop them needing them at all, you know, is a green action. But also making sure that, you know, people have an understanding of how to measure this. So we have carbon footprints, you know, for, you know, pathways of receiving care. So depending on whether it's inpatient, outpatient, etc., you know, we have a rudimentary carbon emission factor for use of pharmaceuticals. So there is a way that you can quantify healthcare. And what we're trying to do is enable pharmacy teams up and down the country to quantify the work that they're doing, so that people become educated in, you know, in the sustainable environmental impact of existing work streams, as well as looking at, you know, really easy wins that maybe people haven't thought about before. So, as you know, Minna mentioned the formulary. You know, we took a brilliant example from Sunderland. And they've made sure that their formulary application form and every single clinical guideline they have has a section on deprescribing. Now, that's been proven. You know, it's in the National Overprescribing Review as one of the barriers to stopping unnecessary medication. And it's so easy. You know, so we've put that in there. Other things we've done is share a link to a document that helps healthcare teams manage their pharma waste easily. So there are all sorts of different ways, and we are just trying to document it so that we don't have to duplicate the work and sustainability work becomes more sustainable.
That's fantastic. Schemes like that, checklists and things like that are so important. So one thing that's been really successful in primary care is the greener practice toolkits, particularly for inhalers, and I'm sure you'll have seen that. And I do think you're right, there's a sort of disconnect between the big aims set out in policy documents, which are really important, but then there's this gap between, well, how do you get there if you're a local team? So that sounds really practical and things that people can take on and, as you say, integrate so that this is normal work, because it is core work. This is win-win. You mentioned deprescribing. That's often a huge benefit to the patient individually, as well as all these huge gains in terms of the environmental impact. So most of these things, when we're talking about sustainability, they're wins for clinical care as well, and then also financially. So if we're prescribing fewer medications, it's cost less. So there's no downside to this work. It's so valuable, isn't it?
None whatsoever. And you know, we've done a lot of work talking to senior pharmacy leaders, you know, in England, and that's one of the messages we're trying to get across to them, that sustainability doesn't actually have to be an extra burden. It's something that you're already doing, if you can frame it that way, and you can, you know, that's a really key message. And also, it's not something that's necessarily really expensive. And the real sort of swing for me is that, you know, for pharmacy leaders, it's going to save some cash if it's done correctly. But it's also a really positive message, you know, in, you know, the current climate, everyone's affected by, you know, climate change, but, and people are looking to do something. So we found once you get the message across about how you can incorporate sustainability work into everybody's work streams, you can explain to them why. And it's something that's really engaging teams and really energizing them, which gains its own momentum. So yeah, lots to do.
And if we have junior doctors listening who will be dying to do a quality improvement project, increasingly we're steering them towards sustainability projects, or at least talking about the triple bottom line, are there any things that come to mind that might be quick wins for QIPs in terms of thinking about medication use?
So recently, me and some infectious diseases doctors were looking at IV and oral medications and specific antibiotics, because some of the antibiotics are equivalent, you know, bioavailability wise, given orally and IV. And if you just think about the IV, the plastic waste associated giving IV, the cannula, the giving set, the saline flush, the dressings that's required, versus just a couple of tablets of antibiotics as well. So I'd like to know the full impact of, you know, IV versus oral medications, and clinically how to advise people when to switch in practice. And we were talking about iron, giving iron as well. You know, the latest guideline says that, for example, you give iron every other day. That is as efficient than giving it TDS. So just to review people on iron and reduce that frequency, you can reduce a lot of tablets, and subsequently that the prescribing element is there as well. So looking at how we can review these medications and then increases also the patient's tolerability, because a lot of people, for example, doesn't like to take iron due to the GI side effects, and increases patient outcomes as well, you know, improving patient outcome whilst it's a sustainable project. And it also kind of like giving IV iron, for example, and every few months versus taking it long term, whether the impact of that is better than having a tablet to take every day. And there's a lot of waste management, you know, equipped for clinicians to do as well, and farmers, isn't there, Tracy?
Oh, completely. There's we know that, you know, the bulk of drugs are disposed of in the wrong way. So I don't know. One thing I'd really love to look at is how we convey messages to patients about how they dispose of their medicines, you know, and what to do with them. And I guess you've got to start with the conversation by making sure there's no guilt in, you know, what the patient does and their activity. But there's so much that we can improve in this area, because there's a really fascinating, if you're interested in this, OECD report that came out looking at how patients dispose of their drugs. And that, you know, one of the studies in there said that we think that up to 50% of drugs become waste. But, you know, a really big chunk of those could be avoided if patients know what to do with them. So, you know, are we chatting to patients about, you know, whether they need the drug in the first place? Do they know what to do with them once they no longer need them? And, you know, that's a really big concern, and leads us back to environmental pollution, because we think that, you know, 60% of patients don't know what to do with drugs once they're finished. And that's why you have patients who are flushing things down the toilet. There's a brilliant piece of work to look at, you know, what patients do with different classes of drugs, because we think, or certainly studies indicate that patients treat prescription-only medicines differently to drugs they'll buy over the counter, because they think they're more important, but, you know, they go on to have an effect. You know, we know that patients treat different formulations differently as well. So something like a cream is more likely to be flushed than a tablet. You know, all of these things need to be worked out. And then ultimately, we need to find out, you know, how to convey to patients what's the right thing to do.
That's so fascinating. I didn't know there'd be such a variation, particularly with kind of thinking about different types of drugs in terms of how they're prescribed. That's so fascinating. But of course, that makes complete sense. And I think there's two things that really struck me from what you've just been saying. So one is, clearly we need to question usual practice. So just because things are always done in one way, given IV, actually we need to question whether that's best for the patient and best for the planet. And we really need to challenge those assumptions. And the other thing is, this is on us to change. It's not the patients. And I think that's really important, as you've highlighted. This is not to say that patients are doing the wrong thing. It's just at the moment we don't give them good ways to be able to flag to us that actually they're not taking something. We don't make it easy for them to amend their prescriptions or to say, I don't need that one actually. And we haven't created an environment in which they can question and which they can come with a bag of meds and say, actually, I've been storing this at home, I don't need it. So I think that's very much on us in healthcare to change that.
Janine, just as a, you know, a little anecdote to add on to the end of that, I spent this afternoon having high tea with a bunch of old ladies, and it's really nice, and we just get together and have a gossip and what have you, and we got speaking about drugs, and there were six people there, and four of them said to me, I've been on drugs for 20 years and no one's ever asked me if I still need them anymore. And one of them said, well, I've got a whole suitcase of one of my drugs because I don't like it, but it just keeps coming on the repeat prescription. So, you know, there's so much there. And these are really lovely, but very competent individuals who are up for the discussion. I think, you know, we're all so busy, aren't we? But we need to find the time to chat to these people and find out, you know, what they want to do with their medicines and, you know, if they want to stop.
I think encouraging conversation as well sometimes about to deprescribe someone's drug. For example, I like to use the calcium example, you know, your big chewy calcium. A lot of people doesn't like taking them. So rather than saying, do you take this prescription drug still? I phrase it as, oh, a lot of people think that they taste like chalk. Do you still take them? To make them, like, you know, almost confess in a way and want to talk to you about, like, because, you know, I think patients still have this thing where they're scared to tell healthcare professionals they're not taking the drugs as prescribed. But we need to make them feel at ease to talk about these things openly. If you're not taking them, tell us.
That sounds like great advice. I also really want to come to your high tea sometime, Tracy, with your
welcome
with your older friends. They sound really fun.
It's a lot of cake, yes.
Fantastic. That's all been completely fascinating. I just wanted to ask a little more, because you're involved not only in this work within your workplaces, but also in through Pharmacy Declares and other roles. You know, you've done quite a lot of speaking, you advocate for people to change. What kind of things are you doing, or do you encourage people to do in their own lives, or using their healthcare voice to try and tackle this huge problem of the climate crisis that we're all trying to fix?
So personally, since meeting Tracy, I've had to, you know, change all my banks, and they're all green banks certified. And I've also changed my energy suppliers, renewable energy, albeit more expensive, but I think they're worth it. And I looked at the profile data of the companies I'm with for any other subscriptions, including the ones for our website, for example. Our host website has got a sustainability page and what they're doing outside. That's why we chose that website. And I think Tracy mentioned this before, a lot of people are bogged down and focusing on, you know, recycling milk bottles, your paper at home. But we need to target the bigger fish. The people driving, you know, this climate change are the fossil fuel polluters. So as healthcare professional, we have a duty, don't we, to raise this, you know, joining in the streets with other healthcare professionals and highlighting the links between how this impacts the health in the future and how healthcare professionals. I think, Tracy, you're more involved with kind of this avenue. Do you want to?
I'd love to, if that's okay. I just think it's so important for healthcare professionals or pharmacy professionals to know that, you know, this is something they should be speaking up about. I get the impression, comparing us to other healthcare groups, that pharmacy professionals are sometimes quite reserved. And, you know, we're very risk averse by nature because, you know, we're detail oriented, et cetera, et cetera. But I just think it's really important that teams in health realise, you know, what's important and what's driving their patients to need healthcare. And so I think it's, you know, we would never as a profession support a tobacco industry sponsoring something, or go to any organisation, being sponsored by the arms trade, etc. But fossil fuel companies are going to kill a magnitude more of people than those two organisations. So I think it's really important that we recognise that if we genuinely care for our patients and we're not just there to sort of explain to them how to use their medicines, etc., we need to speak up about this. So we're we're quite clear, you know, we think it's a responsibility of pharmacy professionals to talk up, to speak up about this, and, you know, trying to raise the social license that fossil fuel companies and the institutions that are funding them have because of their impact on health. So yeah, I don't think if you truly care about your patients now, you can step back from this. You know, your professional role has to be patient-centered, and so you have to look at what's causing your patients to be ill.
Well, I'm convinced. That was very, very well put.
There's other ways that clinicians can give advice to help prescribe or give advice to patients to reduce impact from the drugs. For example, I think, Tracy, did you say that you were involved in kids' meds? Do you want to explain about that?
Sure. I'd love to. So, yeah, there's this brilliant program called Kids Meds, which was established by the team in Newcastle. And it's essentially, it's a way to enable small children to take tablets rather than liquids, which has multiple benefits. We know that, you know, the liquids are often unlicensed, the, you know, high in sugar content or other additives aren't suitable for pediatric patients. They really vary in availability, you know, they don't have a very long shelf life. So there are all these reasons practically for patients not to take liquids if they can. But from an environmental point of view, you know, if you're transporting large volumes of liquid medicines, it's going to have a, you know, a higher emissions carbon footprint than if you're transporting small amounts of tablets. And, you know, it goes back to what the project that Minna was talking about earlier with IV to oral switch. You know, you have a reduced amount of packaging, you know, so it all adds up. So I recommend you go and look at the Kids Meds website. It gives you guides on how to teach patients. There's a comic, there's a step-by-step program for patients to adopt. And, you know, if you want to sell it to anybody, it saves the Newcastle team tens of thousands of pounds. So it's just brilliant all round, and it's a really lovely project to be involved with. You know, who doesn't like working with children? It's great, it's wonderful. So yeah, everyone should have a look.
I think Great Ormond Street also have something called Pill School that's similar. It's just also the amount of plastic spoons and plastic oral syringes that comes with each bottle of medication as well. And the bottles themselves are all, you know, plastic and plastic for the minute doses that they contain. And all around, I think that's a great program to get onto if people want to check them out.
Thanks for sharing that. They both sound brilliant projects, and I wish more of my projects involve comics. That sounds like a great way to communicate things, not just for kids. And if people are listening to this and thinking, yeah, it's time, I've been thinking about this for a while, and really I should be doing more, what should they do? What should they do today, tomorrow, this week, just to start taking those steps so they can gain confidence and take action?
I think the power lies in a collective, you know, support. That so whenever I feel really, you know, down, and when I have a green initiative shot down by people who doesn't understand the agenda, I fall back to my, you know, to Almost City Claire's team. I kind of said, oh, this has happened, and everyone's just so supportive, and, you know, try again, or like try it this way, and oh, I'm really sorry to hear that, and that just makes me feel like, okay, there's other people who understand the agenda and driving this forward. I can do this again. It's just that energy that the group gives you. So I think I'd say join a group, your green group that relates to you and what you're doing as well. I think that's quite powerful in terms of keeping you going.
And I'd also say, you know, there are established organisations out there that are speaking up on this political issue. And, you know, I'm going to mention MedAct, and I'm going to mention Doctors for Extinction Rebellion. And I would say, speak to them. You know, it's not a commitment to tying yourself to a politician or anything like that. You know, speak to them. You know, they are extremely well informed on the issue. You can learn an awful lot from them. So, you know, go and reach out to your local branch, or, you know, just read their website, find out what their position is and why people are taking this stance. And I'd also say to people, you know, think about how professional it is to speak up. You know, I think for a lot of people, they feel It's not professional to to raise your voice in something that work that happens outside of the your office walls. But I think going forward, we have to realise, it is a professional responsibility. And you can learn an awful lot from the established teams, and you can gain confidence.
Brilliant. Yeah. Whenever anyone tries to tell me that medicine and politics shouldn't mix, that's massive alarm bells, because medicine is extremely political by its very nature. And so it's an active choice not to engage in the issues that are driving poor health, as you've very brilliantly said. So that's a choice in itself, which is political. So I think we do need to encourage people to be on the side of patients in this, which is the whole point of why we're all here and talking about this today. And that's what drives us. And the climate crisis is front and centre of what's driving their poor health today and tomorrow. So it's been incredible to speak to you. I think we've covered loads.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
Well, thank you so much for finding the time and sharing all of your vast knowledge.
LJ, thank you so much for organising such an excellent interview. As we mentioned at the beginning, you covered tons. And apart from really wanting to go for high tea with a bunch of elderly ladies, that sounds really fun. What, guys, were your take-home messages from that? There are lots of interesting things. I thought the life cycle of medications was really interesting and important, and perhaps something, whilst of course I was aware of, it was really useful hearing them talk about it and describe it in detail. I think it's really key that we all remember that it's not just the carbon cost, which is, I've fallen into that trap lots of times, just thinking about carbon cost, but we also need to think about plastics, the waste of plastics in healthcare systems, but a lot of that comes from our pharmacy, the water pollution from medications. That was really interesting here about the anti-cancer drugs, the NSAIDs causing renal failure, affecting all different types of marine life forms, not to mention AMR, antimicrobial resistance, which is rife and, of course, so key to this area. So, yeah, I took away loads from that. Brilliant.
I really enjoyed talking and listening to them discuss climate adaptation, because I think we sometimes focus on how we're creating the problem, but we don't always pay attention to the fact that heat waves, power outages, really severe weather are going to really impact how we can deliver healthcare. And just thinking about how things like storage of medications is actually really vulnerable. So something we definitely need to plan for.
I think just think about the fact we live in the UK, and every time it gets just a little bit hot or a little bit cold or a little bit wet, or the train services go down, everything goes down, or the transport links go down. So, of course, when we start getting huge storms and massive heat waves, it's all going to shut down, isn't it? It's going to be impossible getting medications to where they need to be appropriately. So, yeah.
Yeah, I really thought there were some fantastic ideas about possible quips. So, you could go away and deliver some of these quips in your own trust, in your own hospital, for example, comparing the carbon impact of IV versus oral meds. So, if there are some journal sponsors out there that listen to this and go ahead and do that, why don't you let us know?
Right. Back to the best bit, the bit which you've all been waiting for, the climate challenge. All right. Last week, LJ and I discussed about how we can, broach things like climate change without badgering our colleagues too much. And at that point, LJ set the next climate challenge, which was a kaiku of climate change. So.
LJ, first and foremost, I actually couldn't remember this, but can you remind the listeners what haiku actually is?
Yes, of course. It's a Japanese poem of 17 syllables. It has to be in three lines, so 5, 7, and 5 syllables. And traditionally, it would evoke images of the natural world, so it links very well with climate change. And in its purest form, there should be a word referring to a season, but we'll let you off about that one on this case. But 5, 7, 5 syllables, that's the key. So I hope you followed those rules.
I forgot the season.
Right, yeah, I do. I don't think I've got a season in mind.
Well, to winter.
John, I think you're up first, aren't you?
Okay.
Okay, go for it.
I don't know if this is the first haiku I've ever written. I think I must have written one at primary school. I was having quite a bad day when I wrote this, by the way. Don't worry, it'll be fine. They told us while the world burnt. It's time to panic.
Wow. That is brutal. And
That is brutal.
And brilliant.
Yeah, there we go. That was written on my way back from work. I think I was referencing the climate change.
was it a particularly awful shift, mate?
I don't know. I listened to Greta Thunberg actually quite recently on a podcast, and I think she just sort of channels anger, which I quite like.
I think there's an appropriate rage about the inaction, so I think that's absolutely right.
Rage in a constructive way, I like it. All right, I'll go up next. Okay, I think maybe mine is equally bleak. Bloody hell. Okay. Hooray for fresh rain, beating down on burnt clay earth, washing lives away.
I think that is even bleaker. Wow.
Only when I read it out, this is the first time I've read it out loud. And yeah, that really, there we go. I think I did it when it was back in the heat wave and everything was looking pretty bleak. And I think, I was feeling pretty bleak. There we go. Okay.
Agent, please give us some hope.
Yeah.
So I have taken a slightly less bleak approach. Absolutely. So I have stuck more to a respiratory theme, because a lot of what I think about is about air pollution, and so that's the theme of mine. So slightly less soul destroying perhaps. Okay. Autumn cools the air, burning wood feels cozy, but lungs feel the damage.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. So I don't know if people realize that PM2.5, a large proportion of it comes from wood burning stoves, and lots of people will be starting to burn theirs now as the temperatures drop, and that's a massive problem. So
it's about a third, isn't it? About over a third. I think it's like 30. I think I saw 38% in the latest thing of it comes from wood by wood burning fuel.
Even higher in some city locations.
Yeah. The Journal Spotting Climate Anthology of Poetry coming to a stocking near you for Christmas.
Actually would be excellent. I think everyone did really well. It's not easy to channel your creativity and then to put it out there. And I think it's really important to channel our emotions about these things into something. And
that is some deep-seated emotions sort of just in there, just what we're actually feeling. Oh, well, look, on that very, very positive note, everybody, I think we should say goodbye to our listeners, and they will be joining us for the next Climate Zone, which will be on an awesome interview about oceans and the effect of climate on oceans. So look forward to that. And after that, we've got an interview with a professor on microplastics. So we've got loads coming your way. The next episode on Journal Spotting will be a roundup. So have a listen to that, guys. All right. Thank you so much, everybody, and take care, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You have been listening to Journal Spotting with your hosts, Dr. Barnaby Hirons, Dr. Jonathan Hudson, and Dr. LJ Smith. Information and links from the show can be found on our website, journalspotting.com, or on Twitter. Thanks to Mesley for co-creating the Journal Club app. Get the link on our website. If you enjoyed the show, subscribe and leave a review. If you have any feedback or questions, get in touch via our webpage, our email, journalspotting@gmail.com, or tweet us. Disclaimer time. This podcast is for educational use only. The views expressed are opinions based on our experience, the experience of our guests, and the evidence we read. We are not affiliated with any particular institution. By listening to this podcast, you agree not to use the information we share to make decisions on how to treat your patients or yourselves.